Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens and what can we learn when tens of thousands of cute little plastic tub toys spill out into the ocean? Nearly 20 years after a storm knocked a shipping container into the North Pacific, the surprisingly complex answers to those questions are still washing ashore all over the world. Journalist and Harper's senior editor Donovan Hone chronicles the environmental, cultural, and philosophical lessons learned in his new book, Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author, who went in search of them. Donovan, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thanks, Chris.
So your first introduction to this fact of news came from a student when you were teaching high school English. Can you talk about the story he referred to in his essay?
Yeah, it was. That would have been the spring of 2005, and in 2003, oceanographers in Seattle had predicted that some of these toys, they were usually in news reports referred to as rubber duckies, were expected to make a landfall in New England in the summer of 2003. And my student happened on one of the clips about that predicted arrival of all these toys. And I couldn't help imagining what it would be like to see them out there on the ocean arriving in Maine or someplace.
And it wasn't just, first of all, they were plastic, not rubber.
Right.
And it was not just ducks.
Right. And one of the things I increasingly learned was that there was a degree of a fable mixed in with the facts, though it is based on, there is a true story behind it all. So they weren't rubber duckies. They were, in fact, polyethylene bath toys, rigid polyethylene, and they came in four varieties. There were the famous ducks, but also red beavers, green frogs, and blue turtles.
And it's interesting when you talk about fable, even the children's book author Eric Carle, who people know maybe best for The Hungry Little Caterpillar, The Very mm-hmm. Hungry Caterpillar, wrote a book based on this story.
Right. And it seems sort of the thing that would be suited to a children's story. He, too, couldn't resist turning all of them into ducks and imagining, happy journeys that ended with encounters with charismatic animals.
Why do you think this captured your imagination so thoroughly? This was before you actually had kids yourself.
Yeah, I was an expecting father, I suppose. Why did it capture my imagination? I think there were a couple of things. One, I didn't know that containers fall off of container ships, and the idea of this spill seemed dramatic, and I wanted to be able to imagine it. And, of course, the idea of these toys drifting across the ocean and perhaps even across the Arctic, the incongruity of that image of these cheerful little icons of childhood, these playthings out on the deep, on the wilderness of water. There was something, it almost seemed like a kind of riddle to solve about that image.
You talk about not knowing, and I hadn't known really before I became aware of this story, how many containers fall off ships every single year.
They don't know exactly. No one really keeps track of how many. There's so many containers on so many ships all over the world. I've seen estimates ranging from hundreds to the highest is 10,000, and that number was reported by Lloyd's List, and I tried to track it down to a hard source and couldn't. But one of the best ways one of the best measures that I found for how many containers fall overboard, and in a way how powerful the oceans remain, is in this story of the worst cargo loss in monetary terms in history, which happened in 1998. A different ship from the one that the toys fell off of, the APL China, was crossing the North Pacific, same route and in the same region that the toy spill occurred, and it lost 407 containers on a single night, and that's just one ship.
And talk about how that happens. You know, we think of these cargo ships as being so large that they wouldn't even move according to the waves, but in fact they do. They'll pitch and roll.
Yeah, and I know from personal experience now, because one of my journeys I decided that I needed to reenact the journey of the toys and experience for myself what it's like to cross the North Pacific at the height of the winter storm season on a container ship. And I will say on that trip, the ship often felt very steady and very little rolling, as one would want to imagine it. But under certain conditions, there are waves out all over the world in certain areas, especially that can grow to phenomenal heights. On the North Pacific, 70-foot waves are a fairly regular occurrence, or even taller. But then there's also the physics of these great vessels and the shape of their hulls sometimes induces almost mysterious phenomena where the ships can roll violently and they get caught in a kind of a rhythm, rolling more steeply with every roll, sometimes to a point where the containers stacked are more horizontal than vertical.
What did it take for you to talk your way aboard that cargo ship?
I tried talking my way aboard, but shipping lines in America have gotten less generous with supernumerary passengers. It's actually kind of hard to get on them now, partly for security reasons. Mm-hmm. And I asked Evergreen, which is the company that owned the ship from which the toys build, and a number of other ones, and they all said no. But there's a shipping line in Germany that does a little side business in tourism. So you, too, could cross the ocean on a container ship if you're willing to pay the price and sign a waiver.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you've seen this particular image from the disaster in Japan, but there are some photographs of a shipping yard where the containers are all just sort of scattered by the force of the earthquake
right.
and then the subsequent tsunami. And I wonder if that sort of made you think about your travels when you saw it.
Yeah, I've been following the events in Japan, as I assume many of us have been, and I do remember seeing that particular photo. I sailed out of Busan, South Korea, and there were container yards very much like that one, but without the containers jumbled. The tsunami story is certainly one of the things I've been thinking about. It's a reminder of just of how wrathful, I guess, anthropomorphizes it, but the power of the ocean. There's reasons why people used to see it as this divine power, and
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we seem to think of it now, first of all, as something we can control. And you make this point in the book that the ocean is so mysterious to us because if we don't have direct experience with it, it just seems like this very large, dark blue expanse that is somewhat uniform.
Right. There's a strange thing where I think because of going to aquariums and because of nature shows, there's a way in which we have more images of the ocean than people of centuries past, but I think most of us have very little first-hand experience, certainly being way out in the middle of it, and that's part of one of the kinds of knowledge I hoped to acquire was just some sense of what the ocean is and what it's like, and from the point of view of oceanographers, but also of sailors, and as Melville reminds us in Moby Dick, that 2/3 of the planet is water, so it's the majority of the planet.
And this inexperience with the ocean until your sort of quest that you went on, this included you. You were not an adventure traveler on the side. You were everything that high school English teacher sort of carries with it. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, I really am not very adventuresome. I did have dreams as a kid growing up by San Francisco Bay. And actually even later when I spent some time in Texas, of being a marine biologist, but I'm not by constitution a thrill seeking adventure writer, though I guess I am now since I've done it.
How did you explain to your wife the first time you really felt like you needed to leave home to explore this story?
The funny thing is I was actually on assignment. Writing for magazines was my summer job when I was teaching, and I was already supposed to do another assignment about the doomed elephants of the Detroit Zoo. And I thought this would just be an easier one to do, maybe quickly, just with phone calls and some swimming through libraries, and allow me to be home for the birth of my first child. But I got an invitation fairly early in the research from an oceanographer to go beachcombing on the wild shores of Alaska, and that was pretty difficult to resist. I explained it to her by promising to call often and by promising to purchase a flight home if there were any sign of my firstborn's imminent arrival. So she was actually very understanding.
And why are these things so valuable to oceanographers?
Yeah, they're valuable. I might not say so valuable, because that's one of the things I learned is they are of value because when things spill from a ship, whether it's bath toys or shoes, so long as this flotsam that goes adrift can float, it becomes almost like an accidental experiment from which you can learn about the movement of currents. So long as the shipping company will divulge where the spill happened, and so long as beachcombers who find these castaways report their discoveries, you've got a point A and you've got a point B, and you can draw a line and see how long it took for these things to arrive and where the currents go. And we might think of currents as rivers in the sea. They've been called rivers in the sea, but they don't flow like rivers. They're really more almost like they move like the wind or the clouds. They shift seasonally. They're variable, and they're difficult to predict. So even in the 21st century, scientists are still studying them and trying to understand them.
So there are beachcombers who are there to find scientific evidence of things. There are beachcombers who are there to look for sort of gee whiz objects. Can you talk about what are they similar in some way?
Those solving the scientific mysteries and those doing it for the fun of it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think of it almost as like bird watching. There really are people for whom it's more than just a leisurely thing to do when you're at the beach, where it's actually a kind of a pursuit or a pastime. And there are books you can get to tell you what to look for on different coasts. One of the oceanographers I traveled with maintains a newsletter, and he puts all of the beachcombers who receive it on alert if he knows of something else that's gone adrift. So there's that element of it. And then certainly once people learn that there actually might be that the flotsam might actually be data, there's an even greater interest still. It might be of use. The one thing that's tricky with that as data is that you don't know what happens between point A and point B. So most oceanographers now use some pretty high-tech equipment to study the current. So we use really what are kind of underwater drones, floats that can surface and beam back intelligence via satellite. Those are expensive, however, and there are parts of the ocean where they are next to impossible to deploy, such as the Arctic. So oceanographers do still study the currents the old-fashioned way, the 19th century way, which is with flotsam or with drift bottles.
Now, talk about why plastic is both fantastic and terrible as something to float in the ocean. I mean, obviously, it is designed to be thrown away, and yet it sort of lasts forever.
Yeah, it's plastic. At the outset of my journey, not only did I not know the ocean, I didn't know much about plastic either. It seemed this magical mystery substance that's now everywhere. But it's a derivative of oil, and it's that's altered chemically. In the creation of plastic, you've taken carbon and you've made polymers that are pretty wonderful because they're easy to clean, they're durable, they're lightweight. They help increase the fuel efficiency of cars, the sterility of hospitals. And yet, like many technologies, they have a downside too, which is in the ocean, they can persist for decades, and chemically speaking, for centuries, because plastic does not biodegrade. And at sea, it does break down in sunlight; it photodegrades, but it just cracks up into smaller and smaller pieces. And eventually turns into a kind of plastic dust that chemically can circulate for centuries.
My guest is Donovan Hone, senior editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the new book Moby Duck. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior editor at Harper's Magazine, Donovan Hone. His new book is called Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author, who went in search of them. Join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Donovan, at what point did you realize that it would not be enough to cover this story thoroughly, that you had to find one of these objects or more for yourself?
When I first did the went to Alaska on that trip, the more I traveled, the farther I hunted, the more I learned about, I'd heard of what's now become notorious as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Mm-hmm. The more I wanted to continue the journey because it seemed like there were, I needed to go wherever the toys had gone, and it seemed like there were a lot more chapters in the story I wanted to tell. So it was really from that first trip that I imagined I had in my hands this map that I'd been given by an oceanographer, showing where the toys had been found and predicting where they would drift. And a map is hard to resist.
You know, it's so interesting as you write about maps, and there's sort of a theme throughout the book. We look at them all the time. I have a globe here on my desk, and they don't mean as much until we try to be in the places we're looking at.
I sat there one night when I was first trying to imagine this journey with my atlas of the world flipping through, and they're, I think part of the magic of maps is that they are, at once they're so precise, increasingly now with satellite imaging and all the rest, but they remain abstract. So you look at the ocean and it looks almost empty. You can see the mountains on the bottom indicated topographically, but you can't really imagine the ocean. And likewise, the Arctic, there it is. There are regions of whiteness in your map, but what is it actually like up there? The more I studied, the more captive my imagination was.
So it was on your second trip that you actually found one of the floaties?
Yeah, I didn't expect to when I set out. It was the spring of 2000. I should interject one little thing about my bio because I recently changed jobs.
Oh, forgive me. Oh.
So since I'm speaking, I was going to tell you about the last time I changed jobs, which was in 2007. I'm now the features editor at GQ.
Recently
left Harper's.
Thanks for the correction.
Sure. But in 2007, I was a high school English teacher still, and I ended up quitting my job, and I became a professional ducky hunter. I didn't expect when I set out to actually find any of the toys, considering how many thousands of miles of coastline there are and how vast the ocean is and how small the toys are. But I received word from Alaska that a kind of ragtag group of conservationists who were cleaning up a beach in the Alaskan wilderness had begun finding all four varieties of these bath toys lost at sea. So I got myself to Anchorage and onto a very little homemade boat, and we motored around the outside of the Kenai Peninsula, deep into the Alaskan wilderness, to this isthmus, a beautiful place, but an inaccessible place and totally unpopulated, and yet, because of a fluke of geography, the shape of the land and the currents there, this little isthmus, a half-mile beach, manages to collect tons and tons of flotsam.
I like the story that before you actually found it, it was a beaver that you picked up first. Is that right?
It was a beaver, mm-hmm. Not a duck.
But before you found this, you're like desperately hunting, and this other woman in the party is like, oh, yeah, I found one of those ducks, and I threw it away, and you tear through her garbage bags trying to find the thing.
I really wanted to, but they were piled in these great cairns, these pyramids of garbage bags full of flotsam, and it seemed even less likely that I'd find a duck in one of those bags than I would out in the forest. I did manage during that trip, another one of the people I was traveling with found one, just beat me to it. It was a few feet ahead, and he had mercy. So I did manage to come home with both a hollow plastic beaver and a hollow plastic duck.
What sort of shape were they in?
Well, this is the thing. It gets to the question of where are they now and how long will they stay adrift. The duck that I got out in Alaska was they bleach in the sunlight, mm-hmm. So they're no longer yellow, no longer red. The beavers stay blue a little. I'm sorry, not the beavers. The turtles stay blue a little longer, and the frogs stay green a little longer. But they lose their colors over time, and the plastic begins to get thin and crack. And the duck I found was already cracking. When I got home to New York, I put it in my freezer, and fairly quickly it began to crumble apart. It's now a beheaded duck, unfortunately, which suggests what will happen to them over time, I'd say.
And you put it in the freezer hoping to preserve it?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One is I ended up sacrificing the beaver as a lab animal. I sent it to a chemist, and I had been told that to preserve the data, to freeze it. But also, more important, I wanted to know what would happen to this, to this sea-battered old duck under freezing conditions.
So let's talk about all this plastic and how it degrades. One of the things that you went exploring was the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is, you describe it here as very different than what I had imagined, which was, I thought of a sort of connected flotilla that would cover the surface of the water, and it's more like a an array of garbage.
Yeah, in a way, the name, the Garbage Patch, which is the popular name for this phenomenon, that's caught on, and was the name I first heard. It's a little misleading because, in my mind at least, it conjures forth something like a pumpkin patch or a cabbage patch, something dense.
Yeah.
So I pictured a floating junkyard, and it sounded almost like out of a Jules Verne story, something legendary. And there actually are old stories about places in the Sargasso Sea where derelict vessels collect. And in fact, it's scattered over millions of miles of ocean. It moves with the current, so it's more like a ribbon. And when you go out sailing for it, because some plastic is semi-buoyant, so it's floating below the surface, you're not going to be like bumping into objects here and there and having to poke your way through. You really have to look for it, and really you have to trawl for it with a net because of the fact that the plastic breaks down. So it blows through the water column like dust through air. And so really the best way to see how much is out there, better than going sailing, if you want just an image of it, is to go. There are places all over the world where these collector beaches can be found. There's one on the southern island of Hawaii that's truly impressive, 9 miles of coastline there, that collects more than 20 tons of debris annually. Mm-hmm. And I went sailing to find out what the source of all that plastic ending up on Hawaii.
And at one point you swam in very, very deep water and kind of got freaked out.
Yeah, I'm scared of sharks. I really am. I mean, pathologically, I've gotten scared of sharks when I was in freshwater. So, but I felt I had to, if only for the book, but also I suppose because I wanted to be bolder than I am. I made myself jump overboard and paddle around with snorkels and flippers in the tropical ocean, which, as the captain of the vessel I was with put it, it feels a bit like you're swimming in the sky.
What did people make of what you were explaining you were trying to do when you would go to all these different places in the world?
The reaction is varied. From when I was interviewing locals at a bar in Sitka, an old woman in a leather jacket there said, I'll clean up her salty language a little bit, said, who the heck gives a rat's tuchus about that? You know? So, and then she told me in my yellow slicker that I looked like a duck. But that's from that. That's one extreme. But then I actually think most of the people I talked to in my travels, when I told them the story, found it enchanting. I had one. There was one a member of a crew on a research vessel, an officer on a research vessel I was on. Said even before I did, it sounds so. It's like Moby Dick, what you're doing. You're chasing this duck. So, and I ran into people who had heard the story before, sailors on research vessels, who would come up to me and say, "I'm going to tell you a great story. Did you ever hear what happened to these containers that fell overboard?" So, there's something magical about it, even though parts of it are more fable than fact.
Why is this stuff so bad for marine life?
Well, the plastic. I mean, there's been flotsam, you know, since there's been oceans, pumice and driftwood, and But plastic lasts, so it's accumulating in quantities. And certainly there are marine animals, turtles, dolphins, whales, seabirds, that eat the stuff, sometimes by accident, not always, and it can do all sorts of bad things. It can choke them. It can block an intestine. There was a gray whale found near Seattle, a dead gray whale, and they found in its belly a long list that's in my end notes of things that this whale had eaten, including golf balls and a package of Capri Sun. So there's that. There's what happens when they ingest the stuff. It's also one of the theories, concerns that's still a hypothesis. There's research ongoing into it about plastic. Is it also has the propensity to collect certain toxins that are in the marine environment, industrial pollutants mainly. Chemists have known this forever. They use plastic in the lab for this reason. It acts like a sponge and can absorb things like DDT and PCPs. So if you find plastic that's been adrift for a long time and put it in a mass spectrometer, you will often find high levels of these toxins. And so the question then becomes, if a whale or an albatross eats this, is it more likely than to be absorbing all these toxins as well? And we do know that the animals at the top of the marine food web have high contaminant burdens, and they accumulate in their body fat all sorts of pollutants. It's a question of how it's getting in there and whether plastic is intensifying that effect.
Another thing that you cleared up talking to a biologist, and I like this quote from him. He said, people think that the animals are just stupid and they can't tell. I think the quote was a ham sandwich from a bottle cap. And it's not that. It's that it doesn't appear to be a bottle cap when they take it in.
Right. Yeah, that was Beth Flint at the Fish and Wildlife. And she's one of the people who oversees this marine sanctuary where the albatrosses nest, and she was adamant. She said people in the press often make them sound dumb, and no, but grown up albatrosses, which are really magnificent birds with huge wingspan, their hunting grounds is the entire North Pacific, and they can fly for days on end. They can sleep while flying, and they will forage along the same currents where the flotsam travels. They will forage. Usually their preferred food is squid, but they also look for floating things because they have learned that there's often nutritious things like barnacles or the spawn of flying fish rafting on the bottom of flotsam, so they eat it. And they have pretty amazing digestive tracts. If you've ever seen the beak of a squid, it's sharp and hard and pointy and you wouldn't want to eat it, and they eat them regularly. So they can swallow lots of this stuff, but when they get back to their rookeries, they then feed what they find to their fledglings. And certainly in some cases, the quantities of plastic that the fledglings are eating isn't good for them.
Has it been a challenge for oceanographers to verify sightings of these things?
Of the toys?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sure. In 2003, when the beachcombers of New England were put on alert, lots of people kept finding ducks, and the many of them that were found were the wrong kind, and people tended not to look as carefully for the other three animals. But they are a distinct make. They really look unlike other bass toys, and the duck has a logo on it of the First Years company. And then we also know now, for instance, that if you find a yellow duck, it's definitely the wrong one because they turn white after only several months at sea.
And they were initially packaged together, is that right? Did that all sort of fall away over time in the ocean?
Yeah, little sets of four with a little, you know, blister of plastic and a cardboard back. And I loved that on the package it said things like play in bathtub or pool, dishwasher safe. That's how they were sold in sets of four. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. Reading the story made me realize I don't think of myself as someone who buys things just to throw them away. But I have to tell you, my kids, when they were very small, probably had a dozen of this sort of toy, and not one of them still exists in our house today.
I will admit, I actually, because I found the factory in China that made them, and when I got home, I received shortly thereafter in my mail a limited edition set of the toys. So I've got them myself, and you know, there are reasons why so many playthings are plastic. People 50 years ago were worried, for instance, about polio, and so toys that could collect germs were a concern, and you can wash plastics, and you don't need to put lead paint on them, though people do. So there's a way, and they're light, and they don't break in a way that kids can cut themselves. So again, there's this kind of a wonderful substance, and yet on the other hand, when it comes to the disposability, this is the real problem in the long term, because they really aren't recyclable. Many of the ones that have the little chasing arrows, there's no practical, affordable way to recycle them at all. And even those that can be, you can only recycle them a few times before the quality of the resin degrades.
That's an interesting point because, yeah, we see those three arrows and we think, okay, great, we put it in the recycling, but they get sorted at the facility and often are just thrown into the landfill anyway.
Right. Yeah, and things like styrofoam, whether it's technologically feasible, it's economically not feasible. So whereas glass, you can, in theory, recycle endlessly.
Yeah, because it doesn't break down as you reuse it.
The quality doesn't degrade. But then on the other hand, I was thinking for a while, well, so switch from plastic bottles to glass. But if you're transporting glass from a bottling facility that's far away, it costs a lot more in fuel and in emissions. So it's the I think the one it, when we get to the questions of policy, I think the main impression I took away was that whatever the benefits of plastics, that they certainly aren't as free as they often seem.
My guest is journalist Donovan Hone. He is features editor at GQ and author of the new book Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author who went in search of them. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Donovan Hone. He's features editor at GQ magazine and author of Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author who went in search of them. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Donovan, talk about your visit to the factory where these things are cranked out by the, I guess, tens of thousands.
Yeah, they are. I hadn't expected to actually make it into the factory that made the toys. I thought at least I would gain access to a Chinese toy factory to see where the toys came from and what it was like at the other end of the chain of production from where we consumers usually live. But I got lucky. Even at the height of the, you may remember in 2007, there was a lot of news about toxic toys, and
right.
There was kind of a toy scare, and I was worried that toy makers in China would be reluctant to let a journalist come and poke around. But although chaperoned, I did gain access to the factory. It's the Poxing Plastic Factory in Dongguan, China. I now know, and I've been there. Surprisingly, I mean, I visited a couple of factories that don't, certainly when I imagined Chinese factories, I think I had seen images in the news of these vast, well-lit places with people usually all wearing identical, brightly colored smocks of some sort or another, assembling things. But a lot of the factories are small and almost resemble a kind of cottage industry. industry. So this is a fairly small factory. Up on the second floor, there were workers at what looked like a long picnic table scraping the little remnants of excess plastic from a toy after it emerged from a mold. And then down in the basement were rows, two rows, one on each side of this long room of molding machines. So I was able to, and they were in fact making duckies that day. And I got to see the resin, which comes in little pellets of polyethylene, poured into a hopper and emerged from the other end of the machine as a kind of dripping sock of goo. And then the worker would press a button, there'd be a blast of air that would blow air into this mold, and out would come a long ribbon of ducks that he would tear away. And he'd managed to, there were hundreds in his box beside his stool by late morning when I was there.
It's hard not to be fascinated watching something like that.
I find it fascinating. I mean, I think partly because when we buy things in stores, there's so much wizardry that goes into, well, to make things seem enchanting, right? And in the marketing process, but even in the packaging, and where you go to a store and things feel magically brand new when you break that little seal on a box and the styrofoam is squeaky and everything is all nested in their little packets. It seems, as I say in the book, almost begotten, not made. Then to actually know what's just the material processes, but also the daily experiences of the workers that bring those things into existence certainly held fascination for me.
And you actually had one of the little Voyager ducks with you on this trip.
I did. I managed from an oceanographer to get a set of them pretty early in my journey, and I had it in my pocket. I carried it around wherever I went, and the factory owner in Dongguan said that he had a special surprise for me, and he fetched from his archives the actual molds that they used to make the toys back in the early 90s. They don't make them anymore, so I had to get it out of storage, but there it was, and I knelt down and plugged my ducky back into the concavity from which it had sprung.
Did they know all about the story, and had they gotten a lot of mileage out of it?
They knew, but they didn't know as much. Actually, they were surprised. I, for instance, informed them of Eric Carle's picture book for kids about this story. They knew about it mainly because briefly in the 90s, the first years turned it into an occasion for some marketing, and they put on the back of the packaging before the toys were discontinued a little summary of the story and a little map of where they were supposed to go.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have Ken in Plano on the line. Hey, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm curious to know what aspect of this story appealed to you most of all. You know, there have been a lot of environmental stories out there about what we're doing to the ocean, but this one has a humorous turn to it, almost mm-hmm. like a humorous turn that would... It's very appealing, and I'm curious to know whether it was that or something else that sort of drove you to the level of detail that you seem to have mined here. Thank you very much.
Good question. I'm glad you asked it, because I really, when I set out to write it, well, one, I was under the spell of Moby Dick, which I've taught and read probably too many times, and very much wanted to be able to, like Ishmael, travel the ocean and describe it with a certain amount of awe and wonder. So it's, in a way, it's a travel book first and an adventure book. And when I set out, I didn't realize there was going to be an environmental angle at all. It was only once I'd begun traveling that the currents carried me quickly into these other questions. I think part of what makes the book a little difficult for bookstores to know where to put it is that it is inevitably an environmental book too, because you can't write about the ocean. You can't do straight science writing about the ocean now without stumbling into environmental waters.
I think it's also easy for anybody to close their eyes and imagine a fleet of these little things bobbing in the ocean.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I had cartoonish visions of them, exactly, of them, the nodding yellow faces out there on the waves or washing in a yellow tide. And I pulled out, actually, recently I had a one of the clippings. It was a Reuters item that ran in the New York Times where they even, this was in 2003, they said things that, what does it say, that they'd floated through the Arctic and past Greenland, and flotillas on the way, and a breakaway group has been spotted heading for Britain. Like, the breakaway group has been spotted. They weren't actually spotted. There were tantalizing reports, and there were predictions. But that image of them crossing, going cheerfully where explorers had gone boldly and disastrously before was awfully charming.
You know, we see it so often. It seems like something that is inevitable. But why is it that we give our kids toy animals to play with?
Well, this is, you know, partly because if you call your book Moby Duck, then you almost are obliged to think about the yellowness of the duck, the way Ishmael thinks about the whiteness of the whale. But I quickly discovered that it was more interesting than one might think. It's because, for one, toy ducks, which are really a creation of the 20th century, initially made from rubber, and then ever since the 50s, mostly from plastics, they're a fairly recent phenomenon. But there used to be many different varieties of them, and now suddenly we have this one yellow one that's become iconic. And if you're a parent, you probably can confirm that you'll see, if you keep your eyes open for them, you'll see them everywhere, in baby stores and toy stores. Old Navy uses one as the logo for its infant wear section. So that seemed to me a question worth thinking about. And then I also discovered that there really is only one breed of duck that has perfectly spotless yellow ducklings. So, and that led into, in some ways, there's an interesting history of the association of animals and children. Certainly, I think even anthropologists can confirm that children all over the world, there is something, an innate curiosity and interest in them. Who knows? Perhaps we evolved to be paying attention to potential sources of food, or who knows? but then there's something else in the last couple of centuries, where not just more than just a curiosity on the part of children, we as grown-ups associate children with animals and toy animals, and you'll see in portraits from the Victorian era often that children are posed with an animal, and I think that the toy duck, in a way, is not just a kind of brand for selling toys and other products for kids. It's also in some ways a representation of childhood, this innocent, harmless, vulnerable little animal that is forever smiling. It's in a way how we would like to think of children.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My son's first word was duck, and he learned it because of the little yellow tub toys that he had. And it took him a while to understand that that was the same thing that we would see that was brown and swimming around a lake that's near our house. He didn't make the connection because they don't look anything alike.
Yeah, well, I have two sons now, and my youngest, whenever he sees in a picture book a picture of a mallard on a pond, he mistakes the pond for a bathtub.
Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Do you have now like a collection of different kinds of ducks, or have you tried to avoid that given all the environmental weight of what you ultimately learned?
Well, you know, and I've been given ducks, I for very well-intentioned reasons, and I was very grateful for the gesture, but I do not have any desire to accumulate a collection of them. It's hard. I don't feel like it's even possible to be a kind of a Puritan about rejecting plastics. But I do have made an effort to find ways to reduce the number of disposable plastics I get, and there are alternatives that can be purchased. Unfortunately, it's part of the reason why it's hard to get rid of them altogether, though, is that the alternative products tend to be more expensive, and they're not taking advantage of the economics of scale, and people need to buy things that are affordable. I mean, one of the pediatricians I spoke to, who'd lent his name, a seal of approval to these particular toys, was very quick to say to me the reason why he wanted to approve them was his greatest concern was that affordable quality toys were available even to kids of few means, and that's often means plastic.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ryan in Fort Worth. Hey, Ryan.
Yes. You mentioned that these animals, the ducks and stuff, with time lost their color, and I suppose became kind of a pale color. I'm not sure what color, but but also the name of the article is of course, Moby Duck, and you've taught the subject. I was wondering if you got or thought in terms of possibly a metaphor between the ducks losing their color and also the whale losing its color. It was once colorful and now white, if that ever came to your thought process, and I'll listen off air.
Thank you. It's a good question. You must be a Melville fan. They do turn white. They turn a very pale, kind of the color of the flesh of a banana. It occurred to me, but in a way, I decided that it was more interesting for me to think about the yellowness of the duck because, in a way, I thought that I was chasing two different quarries. I was chasing the actual toys of fact that fell off the ship, but then I was chasing this fable of the ducks lost at sea. And there are images of it all over the place, in news stories, children's books. There was even a cell phone company in England that, for an ad, made a movie that visualizes these ducks drifting around the world up the Amazon through the Arctic. So it's become a kind of 21st century fable, and in the fable it's always yellow. So that's what I tended to think about.
How do you know when a quest, particularly one that is sparked in part by a fable, is complete?
I think in my case, it's a good question. Maybe when you're just sick of seafaring and you miss your kids. but for me, the other answer to that is that from very early on, the part of the story that most captured my imagination was the idea of them drifting through the Arctic, because the Arctic, of course, is in and of itself an object of fascination. It used to be an object of great mystery, which is why all those foolish and in many cases suicidal Victorians went trudging off into the ice trying to find a Northwest Passage or to try to find what there was at the North Pole. So it's a mythic landscape. So you had a fable arrive in a mythic landscape, and the ducks seem to me in some ways the very opposite of all that the Arctic represents in our mind. So I had to get to the Arctic, and that is where my journey ended, deep in the interior of the Northwest Passage.
And I'm also curious as to whether, as you talk about this now, are they more familiar with the real story, or does the fable still appeal to them more?
It's that's a good question. I mean, I think that certainly the fable is still alive and well. In 2007, the rumors spread to England that the flotilla of ducks was about to arrive, and the tabloids in London lit up, and they said, here they come, and lo and behold, a beachcomber near Dover found one, and they said, the first one is here, the invasion begins, and of course, it wasn't the right kind of duck, as I could tell right away when I saw the photo, and no one bothered with the corrections, so it still keeps going, and I can, it's a charming story, and you know what, it's charming in the facts, too, that these toys, 28,800 of them, they may not have gone all over the world.
I'm going to have to jump in. I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Donovan Hone is features editor at GQ. The new book is called Moby Duck. Donovan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. It was great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.